Well, good evening, everyone. Before we look at the book of Ruth, would you mind turning, please, to the book of Job? So the book of Job, just before the book of Psalms, chapter 1. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to take turns holding feasts in their homes, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular custom. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. One day, when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were ploughing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabians attacked and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the sky and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 raiding parties and swept down on your camels and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the 4 corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. If we turn back now, please, to the book of Ruth, on page 210. And we're going to read the first chapter again, and we're going to look at the conclusion of the book. So, Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and 2 sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name Naomi, and the names of his 2 sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Epaphrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her 2 sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughter-in-laws, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you've shown kindness to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." At this, they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. And if you turn, please, over to chapter 4, the last chapter. We really should be reading all of this in between, but we're saving that up. So we're picking it up in chapter 4, verse 13, where by this stage Ruth is married to Boaz and has had a child. This is what we read from verse 13. "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, 'Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, as has given him birth.' Then Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap and cared for him. The women living there said, 'Naomi has a son.' And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nashon, Nashon the father of Salmon, Salmon the father of Boaz, Boaz the father of Obed, Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David." Well, after tonight's message, you may be saying to yourself, "I thought this book of Ruth was about Ruth, not Naomi." what are we doing this morning, this evening, coming back to Naomi. If you came across this first chapter of Ruth, found it lying on the ground as a single page, you might well ask, well, why is the title of the book Ruth? For chapter one does centre on Naomi. And the reason for that, as we shall see, the story of Ruth is very much a story about Naomi. And so I hope that you find tonight's further consideration of Naomi to have been worthwhile. Last time we were in this first chapter of Ruth, we turned to an event in the life of Abraham in Genesis, where soon after the Lord had established him in the promised land, Abram took leave, went away from the Lord's chosen place for him, and went to Egypt. He took matters into his own hands, and he chose to sojourn in Egypt for a time. We considered Abram because of the similarities between the faithless action on his part and that of Elimelech, Naomi's husband, who also took matters into his own hands, moved his family off away from Bethlehem, where the Lord had settled him. And Bethlehem was a special place in God's economy. It literally meant the house of bread. Elimelech moves away from the house of bread into pagan Moab looking for bread. And there, with all the prohibitions concerning the formation of relationships with the people of that land, a self-appointed, expedient undertaking, all because, as with Abram, there was a famine in the land. Now, to what degree was Naomi, Elimelech's wife, to what degree was she with him in this, intending to just up and go and sojourn in Moab for a time? Was it just Elimelech who made the decision for the family? We're not told. Naomi may have very well, being a godly woman, and if she's anything like my wife, she may very well have pointed out to Elimelech the inappropriateness of this undertaking, and even expressed to him her disapproval. But nonetheless, she found herself with no other choice than to tag along, to go. What we do know, without a doubt, is that short of her own death, Naomi was the one who bore the pain of all that followed. It was Naomi, the woman, the now widowed and childless Naomi, who was left to carry the burden, to feel the grief, experience the loss, all as a result of Elimelech taking his family away from Bethlehem. And as we considered in depth last time, Naomi was a woman of faith. And as the story in the following chapters will bear out, the grief and the losses incurred as a result of this move to Moab is not the end of the story for her, just as it wasn't for Abraham following his move to Egypt. The amazing thing about Abram is this. It wasn't just the once there in Genesis 12, as we read last week. It wasn't just the once that Abram sought to pass his wife off as his sister, but again, the same thing in chapter 20, when he strategizes yet again to save his own neck by repeating the ploy of passing Sarah off as his sister, this time to a different king in another land. Well, might we have cause to think, well, surely that's got to be it for Abraham. That must be the end for Abraham as far as the Lord's interest in him is concerned and the Lord's dealing with him. Abraham must be on his own after that. You might be tempted to think the same thing about yourself after repeating the same sin in your own life. For I most certainly have. How can the Lord possibly accept me when I have so seriously and so willfully sinned against him in the same ways as before? And possibly that thought went through Abram's mind as well after repeating his sin. But it wasn't the end for Abraham as far as the Lord was concerned. There's much more to the life and the story of Abraham. What is the Lord's assessment of the overall life of Abraham? He is acknowledged as a man of faith, of saving faith. He's up there with the likes of Moses, Twice in the book of Hebrews, in the New Testament, we find reference made to the faith and the obedience of Abraham. Now, was Abraham perfect? Certainly not. Was his faith perfect? Certainly not. But you see, the one in whom he had faith was perfect. Perfectly faithful, perfectly merciful, perfectly just, and the justifier of all those people of faith like Abraham, whom God declares righteous in the finished work of his Son, even though the Son at this stage has not yet come to earth to do that saving substitutionary work on their behalf. And friends, the same is true for you and me on this side of the cross. If our faith is likewise in that same God and his Son, God forgives and accepts, just as God forgave and accepted Abraham because of the transferred righteousness of his Son. The same is true for us. Well, God continued to work out his purposes through Abraham, the man of faith. God continued to work out his purposes through Naomi, the woman of faith. Naomi's faith is expressed against a very different background, certainly different circumstances to that of Abraham. Abram's faith was called for, firstly, when God asked Abraham to uproot, to make the move and follow the Lord to the promised land. It also involved Abraham hanging in there for what seemed to be the Lord's failure to deliver on a long-promised, long-awaited-for son. With Naomi, on the other hand, there was no promise for a son to be given. Naomi's faith was in nothing and no one but the Lord himself, for she had nothing to return to, nothing to look forward to, no home, no parents, no husband, no daughters, no sons. There were no specific promises made to her as there had been promises made to Abraham. No promises, just losses, one after the other. So the testimony that Naomi bore of the Lord's dealing with her is very different to that of Abram, and yet overall, as we will see, she bears a remarkable testimony to the Lord. Naomi's extremely sad situation was more akin to that of Job, of whom we've just read. In that conversation between Satan and the Lord, God says of Job, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." Job, likewise, a man of faith. That's not to say that he was without sin. And we find as the story unfolds that he has need to learn certain things about himself and about God. And Naomi, likewise, a woman of faith. She speaks with certainty and out of proven experience of the great truths of the Lord. And she tells of these to Ruth, as we considered last time. She knows the Lord, not just the facts concerning him, his eternal nature and how he works and so on. She really knows him. She walks with him. She goes through life with him as her Lord, and all of these calamities happen to her. Consider what happened to Job in the first chapter of that book. There in chapter 1, we read of the Lord allowing Satan to progressively take away from Job one blessing after the other. First, his livelihood, his animals, his property, and finally, as with Naomi, his children. At which we read, "At this, Job got up and tore his robe, and then he said those famous words, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away.'" And then immediately follows the Lord's assessment of Job's response to all these calamities. "In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Job, just like Naomi, Naomi, just like Job, have both lost just about everything except their own lives. For both of these people of faith, in extreme ways and to extreme measures, the Lord took away from them. And they both freely admit to that. Naomi says to Ruth in verse 13, "The Lord's hand has turned against me." And then to the women of Bethlehem in verse 21, Naomi says, "I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty." Both Job and Naomi attribute the calamities in their lives to the Lord. And yet it was said of Job that in speaking of these things in this way, he did not charge God with wrongdoing. Indeed, friends, think about this. Rather than see these words from Naomi as she speaks to the women of Jerusalem, rather than seeing that as a departure from faith, as it were, a flaw in Naomi's life and her walk of faith, ask yourself, is this not rather a telltale sign of and a testimony to the reality of her life's walk with the Lord and her very trust of him, to be able to say what she says? Both Naomi and Job can speak and do speak in this way of what's happened to them because of and only because of their long practiced and proven faith of confidence in the Lord's faithfulness. Only such faith enables the likes of Naomi to speak in this way and attribute all that's happened to the Lord. For Naomi, the same faith that enables her to say to Ruth in verse 8, "May the Lord show you kindness because he's a kind God, and may the Lord grant that you find rest because he's a true rest-giving God." That's the same faith that enables Naomi to speak as she does to the women of Jerusalem in verses 21 and 22, "I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty." See, our present, and Devin touched a little upon this morning, incidentally, our present somewhat sentimental Christian culture tends to place emphasis upon those testimonies in which God's activity results in good developments, in improved circumstances, and outcomes that at some point have a happy ending. And so you come across books and you hear conversations, or it may be on a Christian radio station or an equivalent television broadcast. You know, the Lord has really blessed your ministry, hasn't he? Your church is bursting at the seams. Or just look at what's happening to your business. The Lord has blessed with success as you've been faithful. It goes from strength to strength. The growth is so evident. The Lord has been so good to you. The thinking that lies behind such selective presentations is the notion that somehow testimonies like that will warm people to God, encourage them to believe if they haven't done so already, or to encourage believers to believe more strongly for themselves. I don't know whether it works that way. This is where Naomi hits this prevailing, almost simplistic mindset hard on the head. For Naomi's testimony is one of bankruptcy. Her faithfulness leads to a thorough emptying and taking away of everything that she has. This is no crowd-drawing success story. And she tells it like it is. And moreover, she identifies the source, the one who was ultimately responsible for her being made empty. "The Lord's hand has been against me. The Lord has brought me back empty. The Lord has brought this misfortune upon me." There's a tendency for us, as with many preachers, when dealing with Naomi's words, to read them through that's the same prevailing culture. And when we do, our response can be something like, "Oh, Naomi, where is your faith? Naomi, why do you speak this way? Why are you so bitter?" Especially so when in verse 20 we read, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter." But you see, Naomi herself is not bitter. She is not in herself bitter. She's certainly not bitter towards God. Yes, she chooses to call herself by a different name, namely Mara, because the name Mara more accurately conveys the terrible circumstances of her life at this stage. Undeniably bitter circumstances, terrible circumstances. So much so that the name Naomi, meaning pleasant, just doesn't fit. Naomi knows that the death of her husband, followed by the death of one son, followed by the death of her last remaining son, it's not circumstantial. It's not just some unfortunate statistic in the inevitable cycle of life, which all happened to happen at once for poor Naomi. No, there's nothing of faith in that. Naomi wouldn't own that. This has been the Lord's doing. This has been her Lord's hand that's gone out against her at this time. And she can say so because she knows her God. And she can say so without being bitter and without accusing the Lord of wrongdoing. As I considered Naomi's story, I recalled the words of C.S. Lewis from The Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe concerning Aslan the lion, who of course in the story represents Christ, the Lion of Judah on the throne. Mrs. Beaver is speaking to Susan in the story, the young girl, and she says, "Aslan is a lion, the great lion." "Oh," says Susan, "I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion." "Safe," said Mr. Beaver. "Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver is telling you?" "Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you." Naomi's experience of the Lord certainly hasn't been a safe one. How many of us want a safe life from the Lord? But over it all and under it all and in it all, for his daughter Naomi, he is good. And Naomi testifies to both. She testifies to his unsafeness and his goodness. And the remarkable thing is this. All this honesty about the truth of who God is, the Lord, and what he does, and the losses for which he's ultimately responsible, is used. It's actually used by the Lord to impact upon Ruth. And it's to impact for good. When Ruth sees, when Ruth looks at her mother-in-law, she sees a woman who, in one breath, can say in all honesty and sincerely, "The Lord shows kindness, and the Lord is true, and the Lord grants rest." But it can also say that because she knows it to be true, but also says, "The situation and the consequences of all that's happened, this is more bitter for me than it is for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." How amazing. How amazing that a testimony like this, one that speaks so strongly of the Lord's taking, hardship-creating, grief-giving activity, should be used to bring a pagan Moabitess to the point of saying, "I want this God. I want this God to be my God. Naomi, I want your God to be my God." How counterintuitive is that? How gospel-like is that? Back to front, countercultural, past finding out God's activity. A testimony like this to bring about a response like that from Naomi. A word of faith and a life of faith from a distraught, grief-stricken, barren widow, used by the same hand that's gone against her to birth in a pagan Moabitess. This was such a declaration as, "I will have the same God to be my God." When through the deep waters he calls you to go, the rivers of grief shall not you overflow, for he will be with you in those troubles to bless and sanctify to you your deepest distress. He will be with you in those troubles to bless. And has that not been so? Has the Lord not blessed Ruth as a result of Naomi's troubles? Moreover, the grief, the troubles that his hands have dispensed to Naomi, he will also orchestrate and superintend so as to ultimately bless Naomi herself. There are wonderful blessings in store for Naomi. I said earlier that Abraham's faith was in the Lord's promise that a son would be given, and extending from that son the greater promise of a nation of people, descendants of Abraham, that would follow. Now, in the culture, in that culture, as we considered last time, that was a wonderful promise. For family was everything. You married to have a son and so ensure the continuance of the family name. What Abraham didn't know, of course, when the Lord made that promise to him, what Abraham didn't know, and what you and I would never have known unless the New Testament told us, is that the nation of descendants that God had in mind for Abraham all along was not Abraham's natural descendants, but rather all those from every tongue and tribe and nation who would believe in the Lord as Abraham had believed the Lord. All those who would come to share with Abraham that same saving faith that he, as the father of faith, had. In other words, believing descendants are Abraham's true descendants. But Naomi, again, has no such promise from the Lord made for her. Indeed, the Lord takes from her the son, both sons that she did have. And given her particular circumstances and age, she would be prohibited from bearing another son to replace what she had lost. When I was at school, which was a long time ago, the only attractive feature that I found in being there, the one thing that gave me an incentive to go back year after year for 10 years, was the opportunity to sing in the school's annual Gilbert and Sullivan opera production. I dreaded the classroom, but I loved to sing. I can remember as a boy soprano, as a treble, with all the other trebles, dressed up as maidens or as fairies. That doesn't leave here, all right? Depend upon the opera. Nervously waiting behind the curtains in the wings off stage. On stage would be the basses and the tenors singing some heavy melody in a minor key against a dark backdrop. And then the orchestra, who knew what was coming next because they were following the score, the orchestra would swing into a lively maiden's chorus, and a fresh, colourful backdrop would cascade down, and we young boys would burst upon the stage with gusto to sing some merry, lively tune. Well, the Lord isn't down there in the orchestra pit with a copy of the manuscript. He knows the story, for he wrote it. He knows what's to come, and he knows when it's to come. And while not on the stage himself, he's there, off to the side, hiding in the wings, but completely in charge, even though he's completely out of sight. And it's from there that he choreographs every movement, onto the stage and off from the stage. All that happens is in accordance with his perfect orchestration and great wisdom and love. And so he directs Naomi. The Lord, whose hand for a time has gone out against her, nonetheless holds her in his hand. He is dangerous, but he is always good. And the finale that he's composed for Naomi, for people like Naomi, is a grand finale. What do I mean? Well, for starters, there's Ruth, this offspring of Naomi's testimony, this fruit of her life and word. Naomi didn't even consider Ruth or acknowledge her as Naomi stood there talking to the women of Jerusalem in verse 20, telling them of her emptiness. She was oblivious to Ruth. Ruth, the converted Moabitess, who has walked away from her Moabite family connections and their gods, and has declared that she will instead, even until death, be there alongside Naomi. That Ruth was standing right there beside her. Come the end of the story, we find Ruth married and presenting to Naomi her firstborn child, a son. Naomi at the start had spoken to the women of Jerusalem and said, "The Lord has brought me back empty." These same women now look at Naomi holding this child And they say to Naomi, speaking of Ruth, they say, "Your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who was better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Ruth has so committed herself to Naomi's well-being, so cared for her, so loved her, that the assessment of Ruth by these women of Jerusalem is that she has been better than seven sons to Naomi. And the other thing that the women say as they look at the child is, Naomi has a son. As with Sarah and Abraham, a long time coming, but at last a son. Abraham's son, Isaac, was promised. Naomi's son, Obed, or really God's grandson, technically, was not given as a result of any promise, and only given to Naomi after she had been emptied of all else that she had. This child came as a most unexpected surprise. Isaac's descendants would be all those who shared in the same saving faith of his father Abraham. All those from everywhere, elect from every nation, yet one for all the earth, the people of faith, they would be Abram's descendants. But from this child, Naomi's son, as the women call him, Naomi's son, from him, would descend one even greater. In fact, he would be the ultimate object of worship for Abram's true descendants. He would be none other than the one born to come among them, born to save them from their sin. He would be the king for and the king to be worshipped by all of Abraham's true descendants. Can you see what grand and glorious things Naomi's God has brought about? Only because Naomi continued to trust him even as his hand went out against her. Indeed, it was only because his hand took from her that he was able to accomplish his great plan of salvation in which you and I have come to share. We have Naomi to thank for her faithfulness through those bitter events. We have so much to be thankful for. And finally, friends, if God chooses, when God chooses, to take from you, to move his hand against you as he did here with Naomi, do not make hasty, incorrect assessments of what's going on. Yes, he is not safe in that sense, but he is good. Let's pray. Our Father, you tell us that our eyes have not seen, our ears have not yet heard, and nor has it entered into our hearts of any of us what you've planned for those who love you. Father, your ways are beyond us. They are past finding out, but you are good and trustworthy. Thank you for your servant Naomi. Thank you for enabling her to testify faithfully and truthfully to Ruth, so that this Moabite woman would come to faith in you, and that we as a result might have a Saviour born to us, Jesus Christ, your Son. Father, you've done all things well, and we believe that you will be the same for each one of us here, because of Jesus and because you are good. Please help us, each one, to so love and trust you that we might be a blessing to others. Amen.